Hello, this is Christopher Long, and you're listening to the Digital Dialogue Podcast. I'm here this afternoon with my ETS fall summer faculty fellowship team, Alan Gorky, Matt Meyer, Ryan Wetzel, and today, this is episode 2 of Digital Dialogue. We're going to talk about the question of openness, and one of the things we do here on the podcast is try to think about what the excellences of dialogue are, and so we thought we would begin drawing on our last episode, talking about openness and what does it mean. Is there such a thing as good openness or bad openness, or just openness or the lack of openness? Mm-hmm. We wanted to talk a little bit about openness at ETS and how you guys do a lot of your planning and your mm-hmm. work in a kind of using digital media to open up the discussion. And then maybe talk a little bit about openness related to the project that I'm working on this summer with regard to Socratic politics. We'll see where this leads us. So one of the things we want to think about is have our discussion here be open itself and see where it takes us a little bit. So maybe we could start off by drawing on some of the things that Alan you had written in your comment to the last podcast, where you were wondering if there's a difference between openness and transparency and another. Maybe you could mention what sort of your point there.
Yeah, I mean, I was just wondering about how we're really thinking about openness. If I'm thinking about myself being open, it could mean several different things, and we talked maybe about a constellation of excellences that are around the same topic.
Right.
One of them would mean that, you know, if you want to come talk to me, then I'll respond to that. Like, if you want to send me an email, I'll answer it.
Right. I
mean, that's a form of openness, right? Because mm-hmm. I'm responding. I'm open to engaging in something.
Mm-hmm.
The other part of that, though, and I was wondering if this is maybe more of how we're trying to practice it, is openness throughout the entire planning process. Like, I blog about what I'm doing. And if I go to a conference and I like it, I just write that I like it. I share what I've learned with other people, and I just let them into my brain.
Right,
I've done some of these blog-a-day challenges, and what I find is that as I go through them, what happens is that I start exposing more and more of my raw thinking.
Right.
Because, you know, what else are you going to write about aside from what's in your brain, you know?
Right. Well, I mean, I think that's actually one of the things that I'm thinking about with regard to this project is how much, and we're already skipping ahead a little bit in our points,
no,
but that's
I think
all right.
That's okay.
You know, is how can I do some open thinking in the sense of being more transparent about the process of my research mm-hmm. in a way that invites others into it and invites, you know, people to engage in a dialogue about issues that I haven't fully worked out. So, I mean, I think that's something that I have to work on, and that's why I suggested maybe that part of good openness involves a certain kind of courage, mm-hmm. right? That you have the courage to sort of let yourself out there,
and not be afraid that somebody's constantly looking over your shoulder. Because I mean, some people there is stalking. That's a possibility. Or Matt, you mentioned the thing about the banks. That was you, right?
Yeah. Where a colleague of mine working in the banking industry. E-learning instructional designer says that, you know, everything's clamped down tight there, so they don't have really access to the internet, and, you know, they actually have someone who will monitor their home, monitor their Facebook for the stuff they do at home, because they don't want certain information coming out about anything mm-hmm. related to what they do at work.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the other end of the spectrum.
Well, I mean, I think that's, from my perspective, one of the really exciting things about the web and in social media, and you're seeing that in Iran and other places, where that tendency to control by closing things down, to try to implement a policy or implement a way of dominating others in a certain way, political control, be it in business or in politics more largely, is problematized by the fact that there's so many venues and so many ways to express yourself on the web. So I think that itself is potentially positive. We're also seeing the negative sides. Maybe this is what brings us to the question of good openness versus bad openness, mm-hmm. or maybe the positive side of openness and the negative side. And the negative side is that it's just a whole bunch of stuff out there, and you don't have an ability to filter through it.
I think what you're seeing, especially like in Iran right now, for the political side, is that technology is driving this openness. Okay, the tools of collaboration are here, and you know they're being spread. Almost anyone can have access to them. So I think what you're seeing from this is that like there's no going back. So you better start thinking about openness like we're doing now,
right,
because it's here. There's no going back to going, you know what, we're going to go back and do all this stuff behind closed doors.
Right.
Governments are no longer going to, you know, they're going to have to give in to transparency. From my own experience in developing custom e-learning projects, 16 years ago, you know, there's always, in the development process, there's sub-deliverables, this document. Well, you never hand it to a client until it was absolutely done.
Mm.
Okay. Last year, we started putting practices, what I think the term was a successive approximation, where you are basically showing the client things as it's being built.
Mm-hmm.
That was a no-no 15 years ago.
Uh-huh.
We never did that. Now you do it because, A, they kind of demand it.
Uh-huh.
It's keeping everyone honest.
Right.
You know, it makes the development process fairly transparent, and it gets critical input at points where you would just have to make guesses and hope that the client likes it when you show it to them in 2 weeks. Now you can kind of show it to them. Now you also have to have a trust on the other side,
right?
And that's
well,
the key.
That's why I think that we might be dealing with a constellation of issues around openness, because I think about this in terms of the pedagogical process of planning a class, dealing with a lesson plan, and then executing an in-class, you know, lesson. Where, what if you open that up? I've experimented a little bit with this spring. Open it up to students and ask them for input and get them included in the process early on. That does generate a certain kind of trust. It does get them to buy in a certain kind of way to not only the content but the very process, the course that you're involved with. So there is a kind of community. But I wonder if, when you know, obviously in the business world it's different, when you think in terms of deliverables.
Mm-hmm.
Well, deliverable, I mean, you know, they talk about that in education too, right? What's a deliverable to the student and all this? But, I mean, what if what you're dealing with here is community building in a certain kind of way, and openness is part of that? Transparency is part of that.
Yeah, it's interesting what you said about the students helping build like a rubric or
right.
something like that. Because what I've seen is that some people who do that for one semester, they'll try to take the student-generated rubric and apply it the next semester
right.
just as is. But since that's the generation process didn't happen.
Right.
So then to them, it's
mm-hmm.
not an open rubric for grading. It's
right.
closed because
right.
it was done before they had their voice.
That's right.
In it. So even if they came to the exact same conclusion, their inclusion in the... Yeah, I think I'm saying that right. If they came to the exact same conclusion, the exact same evaluation instrument, the fact that they weren't included or they were included in the process makes
right.
a difference.
So, I mean, I think what we're hearing, and this is an important point, I think, is that it's not just the product, it's the process. It's
mm-hmm.
the way in which you get to the content that you're dealing with. And so one of the things that always struck me about this is when I was doing some studying of Holocaust memorials, and
mm-hmm.
specifically looking at the way the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum was created, one of the things that they very intentionally did was included in the sort of what the museum was going to be about, the very process by which that museum came into being. So they saved all President Carter's order that said that this should be created,
right.
and then all of the discussion, very, very, you know, contested discussion about what it should look like, where it should be, all of that is part of this
uh-huh.
memorial, and it's part of it because it involves the thinking through of what the Holocaust means for the United States and all of that. So I think there's something very powerful about that kind of, and I would consider it a kind of openness,
yeah.
About the process. But what are the downsides of openness? I mean, we're seeing that too, I think, with all the criticisms of Twitter and other things like that with regard to Iran, right? That it's just, people are just shooting from the hip, saying whatever they want. It's, you know, putting out misinformation. What do we think about
Well,
about
I mean,
that?
When it's open and any number of people or resources are interjecting something, you don't know what the credibility of it is. I mean, this goes back to openness, and part of it is community building, because when you build communities, you're building communities of creditworthy people
right.
who are coming in. Not a massive scale like what you're seeing in Iran. who knows what's coming in. So it's very hard. It becomes hard to filter, I think, for those folks, especially like in the news media.
Right.
Like, what's going on? Is this real? Is it not real? I don't understand how they would check all that all the time.
Yeah. The major news networks, they have stated at the beginning that it was impossible for them to really evaluate all those sources coming in. But if you notice, they sort of changed their ways towards the end of that because CNN was getting major, major criticism lobbed at them.
Right.
And the segments that they started to do said, like, they would post the Twitter messages coming in, but they're running it under a headline like "Judge for yourself," or kind of like evaluate it on your own terms and decide if you think this is real. But this is what people are saying is going on.
Right, and if you look at the internet in general, you know, 15 years ago, 10 years ago, same thing. No one knew who was putting what up from anywhere. Then, as communities were built, you could then start to, you know, on your own figure out, okay, this is credible. This I don't know about.
Right.
And with the new the Web 2.0 technologies, I think we're going through the same cycle.
Right. Well, I mean, one of the things that's interesting from my perspective is, you know, this is a huge advertisement, I think, for the humanities and for the liberal arts and for the kinds of things that we teach in philosophy classes about critical thinking, you know, trying to figure out where you're getting your information, how is it being presented, what are the different dimensions of that. It was funny, I was thinking as you were talking, Ryan, that yesterday I found out about Michael Jackson's death from you on Twitter. You Twittered it, and I was like, what?
Wow.
And then I was like, well, Ryan doesn't, I know him. He's not going to be saying something crazy. But of course, the first thing that I did was, you know, go onto the New York Times page and go looking, you know, on places that I thought were credible beyond you.
Well, to verify.
Broken that news to you.
Right. Well, now I will remember. You remember all these times where you were and who told you what. So I was putting the girls to bed, and I saw a tweet from Ryan. That's how I learned.
Well, it's interesting that you say that because last night we had the the lightning storm,
right.
And I heard this huge. I mean, it sounded like an explosion near my house. I mean, it just went on and on and on for many seconds.
Wow.
Not just like a crack or anything, but it sounded like many things exploding in succession. And so the first thing I did was I ran downstairs, grabbed my phone, and I used Twitter. But then I saw other people also commenting about the storm and, you know, the lights going out in their places. So that was almost like a crowdsourced way of verifying the same thing because we were all tweeting about how the same thing affected all of us. So it's like if you see earthquakes suddenly pop up, you know, in Turkey or something, then you know that something probably happened because you just got 10,000 people who started tweeting about an earthquake.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is that I think to a large extent it depends on who you follow. Like I tend to follow people that I know, people whose information I trust, and I don't follow, you know, Ashton Kutcher or anything like that. So if he tweets about something that's complete crap, I mean, I wouldn't even know about that unless somebody retweets it, and then I have to, you know, then you see who it's from and stuff originally. But like you said, if you hear from Ryan that Michael Jackson died, then you know that he's probably not just making that up. Like, he wouldn't really have any reason to make that up.
Right, right. Now you can really mess with my mind by
No, I got you now. Just wait.
Well, that's another part of maybe the growth of a certain kind of openness, or the good openness that grows into a kind of community, a dialogical community, where you know, based on that just example of Twitter, you know, now you you could lose credibility with me if you did start to do those sorts of things. There's a certain way in which trust is earned.
So there's a consequence, you're saying.
Yeah, and there's an earning of trust.
Yeah.
So maybe there's a certain, so it's not just pure openness, this sort of, you know, blind openness to whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But a kind of openness that is verified, checked, and then over time there is a kind of trust built, so that what we're actually talking about when we're talking about dialogical openness is a situation where community is built.
Yeah.
And I think that does happen, Matt. You were saying, you know, when you don't just hand something to you know, a client, you actually bring them into the process of planning for it. There is a way in which you're going to get something, probably a much more positive and effective product than you would otherwise.
There was, and you get valuable input at points in the development process where you need it. Now, the downside, we talk about the downside of openness or that type of transparency was that you can't BS them in a report as your status. You know, you could get hung up on something and you don't really know what to tell them because you know if you get over it, you can make up for it really fast to meet a timeline. Well, everyone knows about it immediately. So,
well, that's why I think a certain kind of courage. I was talking about a little bit of courage with regard to openness too, because I'm just thinking about with regard to this project, even hosting a podcast and doing other kinds of things where I'm out there in ways I'm not normally comfortable with. Even posting, you know, as hopefully we'll be doing, posting notes or thoughts about things I'm reading that are not fully worked out. That is something that you sort of are just putting out there. You don't know how it's going to be responded to. And I assume that, you know, if somebody comes into the onto the blog and writes a horrible comment or a very, you know, angry kind of comment, you know, then I have to respond to that in a certain kind of way. But I'm pretty sure my response isn't going to be to shut it down and to try to control it. I think that that order by control is really not what cultivates community or learning or dialogue.
But I think there's also another part of that is that people who post on that blog normally are logged in. Mm-hmm. So they're normally saying, here is what I think and here is my name attached to it.
Right.
So, you know, if they do say something extremely inflammatory, which I don't think that they would, I mean, on your blog. I mean,
right.
You know, we never know.
There's not a lot at stake.
Maybe somebody will write into this and say, oh, you know, you laughed whenever you said Michael Jackson died and they're mourning it or
that's
something.
Not true. That's true.
Which I understand. I think it was, we just thought it kind of ironic that that's the way that we're getting news from each other.
Right.
I wanted to go back to something else that Matt was talking about with this, this you know, production thing and involving clients. Maybe this is too much. Getting to the point of too much openness, there's this term that I've, you know, has come up every once in a while whenever you look at something that's poorly designed and saying that, oh, it was designed by committee.
Hmm.
In other words, too many people had input, and now it's just a mess.
Yeah.
It's a web page. It's like the homepage of Penn State, and there's just like 30,000 links, and it's because nobody wanted to let go of their baby.
Right.
They all had to have it in there. So
yeah,
that's a really good
but,
point.
But I don't think you'll never get away from having to have strong leadership, management, and governance over something. No matter how wide you cast that net of input that you want to get, if it's very wide, still someone has to be the leader and manage what's going on.
But there's different ways of leading, right? So that there's leading and managing doesn't necessarily mean top-down control, which is what it often seems to mean.
Absolutely.
When you look at something like the way Obama is going about this health insurance, the health care problem, and he's not saying this is the plan that we're doing. He's saying, look, these are the basic principles we need to deal with, and now gives it to Congress to let them work it out. That's a style. That's a strategy. That is one that is not as it's not hands off. But it's not this sort of imposition from above and with and beyond the process. And that's the real, I think, powerful possibility of dialogue and openness in that context.
Right. And I think even more related is the Obama campaign of 2008.
Right.
Now you talk about incredible openness, but yet it was well managed, choreographed, coordinated. Put it any term you want, but it was all started from a leadership style. And
but how authentic was that? That it really has me wondering. Like, was this really? Were these really a lot of celebrities, you know, will have somebody Twitter for them under their name?
I'm not talking about if it's Obama sending out a Twitter. I'm talking about the whole campaign, how it was choreographed.
Sure, but there are also, like, is he just reflecting the sunny side of what he thinks? I mean, how far can you get in politics if you're completely open? There was a show that I saw, and I think it was This American Life. The TV show, not the radio show.
Mm-hmm.
And it was part of it was about this politician who said, I'm never telling a lie. I'm going to say exactly what I feel about everything. And he, you know, is trying to get elected, and sometimes he has problems. I'd have to go back and see the story or something. But I thought it was fascinating because he would just, you know, if he doesn't like you, he'd tell you to your face. I mean, he's being completely honest. But is that too honest, and does that intersect with the openness?
Well, I mean, I think this is your question about authenticity is an interesting one if you translate it back into the pedagogical situation. Because one of the things that I was coming up against in the class last spring was I was really grateful and happy about the degree to which the students were participating in the blog and really mm-hmm. getting involved in really moving the course of the course, the direction of the course, according to their interests and what we were working on together. But of course, that was coerced mm-hmm. to some degree because I was grading them because you knew that, you know, a week where the where I was going to be evaluating contributions to the blog, when that week came along, the blog posts did increase and they did get, you know, more frequent at least. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there, and yet I wouldn't want to say that what they were doing was inauthentic. Mm-hmm. And I think there's something about, would it be great that there's a spontaneous dialogue and discussion that happens? Yeah, that would be terrific. But in the classroom situation, at least, you need to have a certain kind of set of, and that's why a rubric, I think, is really helpful in that regard.
You know, I was thinking this structure is maybe another, and I don't know if it's an actual excellence or not, but, you know, with a situation right. like that, you can't, if you leave it completely open, you'll either get a mess or you'll get nothing.
Right.
Which I think nothing is probably worse. Right. I would rather deal with a mess because at least you can learn from a mess.
Right.
But you could get nothing. Or you could get somebody who's contributing a lot and somebody who's not contributing anything, or people who just feel very uncomfortable. If you put in too much structure, you know, I've seen things like saying, okay, you need to make 2 posts every week, right. and then they have to have a significant. I mean, they're just trying to put some quantitative, right. you know, numbers on these posts and comments to encourage people to do this. If you do too much structure, though, and say, you know, here are the boxes that you're going to fill in for your blog post, and they have to be these short answers.
Right.
They have to address these specific questions. Then I think you're also very limiting.
Right.
So there's some kind of optimal space.
And there's a way, and there must be a way, and I haven't worked it out, but there must be a way to have enough structure to free students to participate in their own way and to give them a voice of their own, to get them to buy in and take an active role in their own education. Without letting it just deteriorate into, you know, people talking about whatever they want and all that. So there's right. Somehow there has to be that balance that's met. And this is, I think, you know, part of the virtue or the excellence of a certain kind of openness is striking that balance where you have enough structure that it's meaningful contributions to discussion. But not so much that it's imposing a viewpoint that doesn't grow organically out of the discussion itself or the dialogue itself.
I don't think we have a discussion about openness without talking about, you know, another one of the risks of it, which is the giveaway of your intellectual property.
Yeah.
You know, that right. certainly has to be the main concern right. about putting ideas out there than someone taking them and running with them and doing, well, I don't know exactly what they would do, but
right.
It's there.
There's so rogue philosophers all
rogue
over the place.
Well,
they're just waiting for you to drop
they're
some crumbs.
They're just philosophizing everywhere.
Right.
It's all Chris's thoughts.
I don't think I have you know, some inflated sense of my own ideas to believe that people are going to be mining my blog for, you know, their next seminal book on a certain topic. But I do think, you know, the ideas are important to me, some of these, and will ultimately, I think, grow into an academic academic journal articles, academic books, ultimately to be used and are ultimately valuable to me in themselves, but also insofar as it helps me get a certain place in my career. But I just don't see. I think it's what the kind of discussion that we'll be having on the blog and on the podcast and in voice thread or whatever things we use. Will still be a living discussion that will need to be distilled and presented in a certain kind of way, so that when I sit down to write an article, write my book, and use these media to do those things, I'll draw on this as a resource, but it still will be my own bringing them together in a certain kind of way that no one else can do.
Yeah. And acknowledgement would be nice.
Acknowledgement will certainly be. Well, so we're saying you guys will get a big footnotes at least, maybe even some dedications involved.
You know, Ryan, I don't want to put you on the spot or anything, but I've been thinking, you being the youngest person on our team,
yeah.
you know, I don't share all of my pictures on Facebook.
Okay.
And I know that a lot of students these days are used to sharing pictures of like, oh yeah, I was at this party and it had a KKK theme and it was so funny.
Yeah.
It happened, believe me. And then those show up in the newspaper and things like that. I mean,
right.
Do you share all of your stuff online? And how do you think the students that you're seeing in the digital commons and stuff, how do you think they make those choices?
I personally don't. Most of my pictures are stored in my iPhoto library, and I just don't get around to uploading them to Facebook a lot. There are a few every now and then, but and I'll have to think about why I make that choice to not make them all available online. But for me, I'm not in the same situation because mine aren't party photos. They're, I don't know, pictures in my garden or something. So I don't think...
You're such a rebel.
I know. So I don't think a lot of people would be interested
today. What do we do?
But the students that I work with in the digital commons, yeah, they don't think twice about putting it up there because for them, it's a network of friends. Mm-hmm. They're not so concerned yet, no matter how many times we tell them to be, about future employers, even professors that get on there and look at that stuff. They're not worried about that. What they're interested about is growing, I guess, their own social capital on Facebook and becoming bigger amongst their friends and sharing all this stuff. And it's like hanging out at the mall, I guess, now, mm-hmm. only it's all on Facebook and you want to have the coolest stuff. And if that's a Billy doing a keg stand, then you're going to put that up there, yeah. and make sure that people can see it.
Well, that's a good point, though, about growing your social capital by being open, because a big part of photos, at least on Facebook, is tagging mm-hmm. people.
Yeah.
So then you can see, like, if Ryan uploads pictures of this session, it'll be, okay, well, part of the stream is Ryan just tagged a photo of you in his pictures, mm-hmm. and then you can go look at it mm-hmm. and see, oh, there's Chris Long, and right. he's wearing a toga.
Right. Yeah, right.
Yeah, well, I'm talking about your ancient Greek philosophy society,
I gotcha.
Where you all get together in Athens. Yeah. And
well, I mean, I'm just kind of struck by this whole idea of social capital. Why it would be considered, why we would want it, why we use this vocabulary of capital when, and maybe it is the right vocabulary to use. I mean, it's influence, it's who's cool, who's not. But, you know, one of the things that I think at least Facebook allows for the possibility of, even though I think it doesn't succeed often in doing it, is a kind of community. Mm-hmm. And what is this? What is this community about being cool and hip and excellent, or who can find the snarkiest thing to say, or who can post the coolest or most rebellious article or whatever, or picture? Or is it about really connecting with people in certain kinds of ways? I mean, it doesn't mean that those are mutually exclusive, but I wonder if thinking about it in terms of capital is helpful, or maybe descriptive.
Yeah.
It may just be descriptive. It's not. Mm-hmm. It may be how people are.
Well, using. I know that people do, at least, you know, a while ago, people were comparing the number of friends that they have right. on Facebook and using that as some kind of status. Like, oh, I have 700 friends and that makes me cooler, which,
right.
you know, I really don't care. The people who I friend on Facebook are people that I really have
right.
an interest in community.
And then it's like, you have 700 friends, but I have 1,200 photos that I've been tagged in, and look how
right.
fun I am, and don't you want to hang
yeah,
out with me?
So
kind of
I think that's right. more like
I
what
think
the,
Facebook, you know, shows clearly a generational divide between what you share and what you don't share, and I think that's reflected in what's going on in work product, you know, and I think that's exactly what Chris is going at right here. This is, you know, this is the openness of what he wants to do. This is the point where, so you know what, it's here. What happens when you go to the next step?
Yeah.
And like, and plan for it.
Right, right.
Actually, think about it ahead of time and say, "Yeah, I'm going to do this."
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So,
and I think when just going back to the comment, maybe we can end where we began. Although that would close things up maybe too much. So, but going back to the comment that you made to the first podcast about the question of narcissism mm-hmm. and the question of internet fame and all
right.
that. And I think that if genuine dialogue is going to be cultivated, it's going to have to be cultivated between people who are not exclusively concerned with maximizing their fame, with maximizing their social capital, with appearing in certain kinds of ways rather than really trying to genuinely put forth a position. I mean, this is actually brings us right back to the one of the main issues that Socrates has with the sophists, which is that they are that he says that they're concerned with appearances and not with truth and not with reality. Mm-hmm. And they want to seem smart rather than actually be smart.
Right.
And so, you know, the issue is, I think that's going to be part of a certain kind of openness also, that you have to have an integrity to it.
So, Chris, do you take an approach with this whole thing, like, what would Socrates do?
Well,
with all this technology.
Well, actually, I mean, I have plenty of critical things to say about Socrates too. So, we'll, you know, I don't want to get into a kind of hagiography of Socrates and praise him too much, but there are some things certainly to learn, and there's a way in which this project is inspired by some of the things that he does, and we'll see some of the things that he fails to do.
Mm-hmm.
When he talks about dialogue, it sometimes turns out that it's not very dialogical what actually gets performed in the Platonic dialogue. So we'll talk about that as we move forward. But I want to end with an invitation to those of you listening to take a look at the Socratic Politics in Digital Dialogue blog, which you can find by going to www.personal.psu.edu and then /CPL2. And that will bring you to a list of some of the blogs that I have here at Penn State. And you'll be able to click on the Socratic Politics in Digital Dialogue blog. We will be posting this podcast there and also streaming it to iTunes U, where you can find us. And so with that, we invite comments, and hopefully the podcast will end by with an openness to more dialogue.
Yeah.
Thank you all.
And I think if we need to come back to this topic again,
you know,
if we get other comments or other questions, we can always review like last week's topic or, you know, a couple weeks ago.
Exactly.
And then continue on with another
form
of excellence.
I think you know, one thing that we've seen here today is that openness is not a single thing. It's a multidimensional facet of dialogue, and we'll have to think about how we cash out the constellation of excellences that belong to openness, a certain kind of openness. So thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.